don't assume that you are all familiar with us, because despite the fact that we are 263 years old, on a daily basis, we have visitors wandering in and wondering, what is this place? And we're always happy to talk about that. But it's my hope that that you will all go forth after this evening and spread the word about us. So please do, and about the awards as well. We are the oldest library in New York City, founded in 1754, in the belief that the availability of books would help the city to prosper. And we are, I think, uniquely qualified to hand out the New York City Book Awards. Since our founding, the library has played an integral role in the literary and cultural history of New York City. We're proud to count many of our founding fathers as members. George Washington, John Jay, John Adams, Alexander Hamilton were all members of the New York Society Library. And in successive generations, many significantly more literary luminaries have been members as well. Tonight, we celebrate the 21st anniversary of the New York City Book Awards. And these are the books that we are honoring as the best books of literary quality or historical significance that evoke the spirit or enhance appreciation of this great city that we live in. I want to congratulate all of our winners. I'm really looking forward to hearing you tonight. Thank you to Ellen Eisman for her generous sponsorship of the awards, to Jenny Lawrence for making it possible for the Hornblower Award for the best book about New York City by a first-time writer. And last but not least, a salute to the New York City Book Award jury, who spent the last 7 months reading, discussing, and passionately debating, I can tell you that's for sure, the merits of each and every one of the 120 books that were considered this year. To winnow that list down to these four extraordinary books was not easy, I know. You have done a brilliant job. Thank you very much. And now I have the privilege of introducing the chair of the New York City Book Award jury, Warren Wessler.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Between this past October and March, our 10-member jury read some, most, or all of approximately 120 books and chose four of them for special commendation as enabling the reader to see New York and its history with greater clarity, deeper appreciation, and often a sense of wonder. My fellow jurors also deserve commendation for their dedication, insight, and judgment. They are Bianca Calabresi, Barbara Cohen, Ellen Feldman, Ella Fauché, Carl E. Meyer, Janice Pomerantz-Nomura, Stephen Raphael, Peter Salwin, and Richard Snow. Would the jury please rise? Grateful to this library for offering us the opportunity to praise them and recognize their authors. The last mentioned volume receives the Hornblower Award given to a first-time author. Library trustee Ellen Eisman generously sponsors the New York City Book Awards for previously published writers, and it is with gratitude to her that I present Ellen Now.
Good evening, and thank you, Warren, for that kind introduction. Each year, I try to say something different, and I hope meaningful, about the importance of these awards. In an era when authors are struggling more and more in the marketplace, tonight I'd like to talk about what solace and enlightenment books can bring to us at a time when the political landscape looks bleak and uncertainty and confusion prevail in so many key areas of our lives, from healthcare to travel. Ever since I was a high schooler, when my late mother sent me here to do research for one of my biology class papers, I have delved into this library's collection for useful information, and with its wonderful trove of books, found pleasure in the stacks. When times were as unsettling as they are today, with headlines about chemical warfare and new nuclear missile tests in Asia, getting lost in an intentionally escapist way in a beautifully written biography, say, is the best salve one could wish for. Good libraries like this one also hold books and periodicals that can provide the truth, or close to it, when the notion of alternative facts and fake news has been accepted by millions of people in this country and elsewhere. No wonder that books such as 1984 are being checked out of libraries and purchased so much more often these days. We want to understand how life has become Orwellian, just a change of power in Washington. As an example of how Orwellian things have become, I'll take just a moment to mention that as an advisory board member of a university library, I recently learned that library groups from coast to coast had organized very quickly to try to save government data before it disappeared in touch of a delete button. The new administration gave instructions to remove references to climate change, for example, and who knows what else could simply evaporate, irretrievable and lost forever. In every new administration, data can be expunged, of course, but in this case, to my mind, the rationale is sinister and politically charged. Libraries remain the keepers of knowledge and spur intellectual exploration. We cherish this institution for the more than 2.5 centuries of offering books, both as a reality check on what may be happening beyond its doors and as a refuge from a world fraught with new perils. Honoring the books selected by the jury gives a boost to the authors who have worked so hard to create them and to the city from which they drew inspiration. In these fragile times, I'm especially pleased to be associated with the Book Awards for their affirmation of unfettered thinking and for all that is valuable about libraries when our cultural life has been so denigrated in the political realm. Thank you for coming.
There's a wonderful episode of The Rockford Files where Jim Rockford's dad, played by Noah Beery, has been reading a bad detective novel, which inspires him to describe an attractive woman as lush and lovely and ready for loving. Rockford, who knows the lady, responds, "Lush, and lovely, and ready for Bellevue." What's interesting here is that this is not a New York show, it isn't even an East Coast show, but the writer can take it for granted that any American, possibly anyone in the English-speaking world, would know exactly what he meant. But unfortunately for many of us, most of the time, that's all that Bellevue means. That place, the madhouse, the nuthouse, an almost faceless institution that's part of our cultural furniture, so vaguely familiar as to become all but invisible. Well, no more. In Bellevue, 3 centuries of medicine and mayhem in America's most storied hospital, David Oshinsky has made it his business to tell us the Bellevue story in fascinating but carefully selected detail. Thanks to his deep research and his deft, lively writing, we get to know the legions of dedicated, daring, and sometimes tragic and sometimes really forgotten professionals who made Bellevue a powerful force for medical progress as well as service to those most in need, especially the poor and generation after generation of immigrants to New York. One of my favorite figures from the early years was Dr. Valentine Mott, who was sort of a surgical rock star in the 1830s, but also was open to new ideas. Because of him, Bellevue was one of the first hospitals in the country to use anesthesia. Just as a generation later, it would be the first big hospital in the country to accept that newfangled, suspiciously European theory about germs. Another Bellevue doctor, Edward Dalton, launched the country's first ambulance service, and another, Stephen Smith, wrote the law that created the country's first municipal health board. Two other Bellevue doctors, Charles Norris and Alexander Gettler, essentially invented the field of forensic science. Their stories and many others are sagas in themselves, but the hospital itself is the star here. Think of any major New York crisis. Bellevue was there, the draft riots, the General Slocum disaster, the Triangle Fire, the AIDS crisis, big time. Right up to the Ebola scare 2 years ago, and whatever is undoubtedly on its way right now. Reading this book, we recognize what should have been obvious, but really wasn't, that Bellevue, like City College, like the public library, is a very big part of New York's essential greatness. A legendary teaching hospital, and quite literally, the go-to place for New Yorkers in trouble. A few weeks ago, a young rapper got his face slashed outside a club around 1 a.m. His friend got him into an Uber car, and this particular story made headlines because the Uber driver stopped the car and threw them out for excessive bleeding. And then what? You know what? Any New Yorker could write the rest of the story in his sleep. They found an ambulance and took him to Bellevue, and they fixed him up. And he was arrested on an outstanding warrant because it was but first the Bellevue doctors fixed him up. So for refreshing and deepening our appreciation and our understanding of one of our city's truly great institutions, we're grateful and we're very happy to present the New York City Book Award to David O'Shea.
You know, Bellevue was the crazy house. When I was growing up as a kid in Queens, if I was acting weirdly, my mom would say, keep it up and run. And that's what Bellevue was. But we also knew from popular culture that, and that came both from Law and Order and The Godfather and the like, that if a cop was shot, a firefighter was overcome with smoke, a worker fell from a scaffold, a homeless person was lying in the street, Bellevue would be that destination. Were the Pope or the President to have a medical issue in New York City, Bellevue would be the hospital that they would go to. It is that good. And what I really tried to do was to show, on the one hand, that Bellevue is the hospital of the underserved. We turn no one away. And yet, at the same time, it attracted the best medical minds for going on three centuries. You know, all kinds of reasons. One, many people simply who came felt it was their duty to help the poor and the immigrants. They knew that when they came to Bellevue, they would see medical conditions and afflictions like nowhere else. And they also knew, particularly in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, that they could experiment on what you might call uncomplaining bodies. And it wasn't a Frankenstein-like place, and it was always to move the medical envelope forward. But that clearly was a large part of it. And it was really this meshing for three centuries of New York City's poor, of whom we asked no questions. New York City, to its everlasting credit, is the only place where the indigent get medical care free of charge, and Bellevue is the flagship hospital that basically provides that. We today at Bellevue speak 150 different languages. No one comes in whose condition will not be fully explained. And that is really remarkable. And this has been going on through the cholera epidemics, the typhus epidemics, influenza, AIDS, which I'll just talk about very, very briefly, and Ebola. And what I want to do in the, actually the minute I've left, is just to give you a sense. The first Bellevue physician in the 1790s, when Bellevue really took over as a pest house on the East River, there was an awful yellow fever epidemic, thousands died. If you ever visit Washington Square, that was the burial ground. And every time they do construction, arms and legs turn up. But Bellevue is the place on the East River, a little further away, where they basically quarantined patients. The first doctor was a 23-year-old young man who basically had simply apprenticed with another physician. That's what you did in those days. He didn't know what yellow fever was. He had no idea. And his solution, as with so many medical solutions in that era, was to bleed and to purge, which wasn't a good idea when you had yellow fever, or almost anything else. On the other hand, he showed a level of compassion that was absolutely extraordinary. When he saw our first drivers treating the coffins with disrespect, he made sure that never happened before. When he saw nurses who were basically alcoholic or not servicing the patients, he fired them. When he saw doctors who didn't have the courage to treat yellow fever victims and who ran away, he condemned them. And his name was Alexander Anderson. He kept his young family down in Wall Street. And in 1798, during that epidemic, he lost his infant son, he lost his mother, he lost his father, he lost his brother, and he lost his wife. Mm-hmm. And he stayed the course. And he stayed the course because he believed it was God's will to do so, and because he believed these poor patients needed his help. He was the first doctor, and that has tradition has been going on for three centuries at Bellevue. During the AIDS epidemic of the 1980s, more AIDS patients were brought into Bellevue and died at Bellevue than at any hospital in the United States. And they were treated with enormous compassion. And actually, the three drug testing was for the cocktail that basically has turned it into it's no longer a death sentence, but a manageable disease, was done at Bellevue. And it was mentioned, where did the Ebola patient go a couple of years ago? That Ebola patient went to Bellevue. We serve the people. Most of our people now are undocumented, they are uninsured, and many are undomiciled. But they know when they come to Bellevue, when they come to New York's flagship institutions, they will be treated with respect and compassion and extraordinary medical care. And I just wanted to make that clear, that that is what we as New Yorkers, and that is what Bellevue as a hospital stands for. Thank you very much.
My delight, it is much more than an in-depth history with generously illustrated images, specially created maps, 134 pages of annotated bibliography, and 100 pages of notes on the chapters. Interwoven with history from Dutch times to the present, with the background of wars, politics, business, and other topics, Mr. Engbinder has given a voice to immigrant life through personal experience of newcomers, including his own family, by researching letters, autobiographies, newspaper accounts, and other obscure sources. There are substantial bios of people like William Brewer, the Steinways, Jacob Riis, William Wall, and unfamiliar other immigrants. And of course, there's a lengthy account of Ellis Island. Mr. Engbinder's previous book, 5 Points, The 19th Century New York City Neighborhood That Invented Tap Dance, Stole Elections, and Became the World's Most Notorious Slum, which was also commended for prodigious research and readability, won an award here in 2002. City of Dreams, the 400-year epic history of immigrants in New York, is prescient. It is so up to date, the well-known aspersion on immigrants, unattributed in the history, but spoken by the President of the United States, is included. This beautifully rendered book should remind present-day know-nothings and nativists who deride newcomers of the intolerance and travails earlier Irish, Catholic, Jewish, Italian, and others endured. They assimilated in time, and their children ultimately succeeded as Americans.
Books
that note that the Muslim immigrants of today are no different than the Jewish immigrants or the Irish or Italian immigrants of the past. So thanks very much.
Jazz Day, an enchanting blend of verse and illustrations, gives young readers and the rest of us that miraculous August morning in 1958, when 57 of the greatest living jazz musicians posed together to be photographed in front of a Harlem brownstone by graphics designer Art Kane. In bringing an uptown thoroughfare to life, the author and the illustrator reveal a magical encounter between the neighborhood's rambunctious children and the fabled gathering of geniuses. In the nearby boulevards, nightclubs, and at apartment rent parties, among other places, these men and women, mostly African American, were in the vanguard of players and composers who invented, developed, and performed jazz, the taproot of our country's cosmopolitan music. Graceful poetry and distinctive illustrations make vivid the musicians' pleasure and pride in one another's company. The players' expressions also show their appreciation for the youngsters' misgivings about surrendering their sidewalk for a photo shoot. How could these restless kids know that they joined a legendary cast if only for a single unforgettable moment? Its concise biographies and stylish portraits of the musicians also make Jazz Day a scintillating introduction to one of our nation's highest cultural achievements. The library commends the author Roxanne Orgel and the illustrator Francis Vallejo, whose book honors New York's embrace of the cherished American music that is in and of our streets.
Beautiful introduction. I can tell you're passionate about the subject. It's a pleasure to be here, and it's a pleasure to receive a New York City Award, a New York City Award, because I focused very specifically in my book on one day in New York City, one day being August 12th, 1958, a Tuesday, a very warm day, and on one street, East 126th Street, and one brownstone, number 19, where Art Kane, who was, as Mr. Wexler said, a graphic designer, not a photographer yet, he got an idea, what if I got together as many jazz musicians as I can for a big group photo for Esquire magazine. They're doing a special jazz supplement. The editor at Esquire bought the idea, and Art Kane borrowed two cameras and brought an assistant who put the film in backwards because he also was a graphic designer. and waited to see who would show up. And it was 10 o'clock in the morning, which is a lovely time. I was supposed to take a photograph, but not for jazz musicians. Show up in their best duds for a photograph. So we didn't know if anyone show, and as we know now, 57, actually 58 musicians did show up, and they had a party. They talked and had a gay old time for about 4 hours before he could corral them into taking a posing for a photograph on the steps of this brownstone spilling onto the sidewalk. And I say 58 because the shot 57 musicians, Willie the Lion Smith, who got tired and sat down on the stoop next door and missed the photograph altogether. So there are all these wonderful stories about this photograph, which are part of a wonderful documentary called The Great Day in Harlem. And I knew that I had a good story here and I didn't know how to tell it. So I tried a picture book, I tried a novel for about 5 minutes. And I tried nonfiction, straight nonfiction, that was really dull. And a poem popped out. And I'm not a poet, and I've never written poetry, but I kind of went with it. And another bit of a poem came to mind about something else about that day. And then another idea about the musicians who weren't there, because they didn't have to be in New York that day. Like Duke Ellington, so he got a poem because he was on the road in Milwaukee. So that was called There's a Hole in the Picture. So I thought about the people who weren't there, I thought about the people who were there, I listened to their music, and I kept writing poems. And when I had about 10, I sent them to my editor, who had published some of my children's books, and I didn't know if they were for children or adults yet. And my editor said, I want that, which is what you do want to hear. And, but I didn't know how to really, how to make poems into a book or a story or like that. I just kept writing them, but Hilary Van Dusen was here today. My editor did know how to make them into a story, so we worked together, and 21 poems became Jazz Day. And we very wisely chose Francis Vallejo is the illustrator. This was his first book, and so he's having a gay old time in the process. And he worked long, long, long hard. He is not a New Yorker, but he made a mock-up, I believe, of the street so that he could visualize it. He went way, way beyond what a normal illustrator would do for a book, so I was very lucky in that. Thank you.
Thank you to the New York Society Library for this exceptional honor. Roxanne and I are so appreciative of this recognition. I would be remiss if I did not thank Candlewood Press and my art directors, Chris Paul and Lisa Rudden, for believing in me, with this being my first book. The legendary American illustrator Howard Pyle always encouraged his students to jump into the picture. Pyle was pushing artists to thoroughly research a subject and preferably visit the location of your subject so you can taste the food, smell the atmosphere, and meet the locals. If you do this, your picture will surely reach a level of authenticity and believability not attained otherwise. This was carried out by so many iconic illustrators, notably my greatest influence, Norman Rockwell. Rockwell was famous for the lengths he would go to apprehend top shelf reference for his picture. So it was these legacies that inspired me in the early days of researching Jazz Day. Thus, on September 2013, I made a trip to New York and visited Harlem to take photos, research, eat the food, which is always a bonus when it includes soul food, and all around surround myself New York City. Our book Jazz Day dealt with perhaps the most New York sound, jazz. So there was no way a Detroit boy like me could duplicate that feeling without jumping into Harlem to prepare for my paintings. Later on, I hired members of the Association for the Study of African American Life and History to pose for my pictures, many of whom grew up in Harlem. I finally created a 3D computer model of the Harlem city block the story took place on so I could have the most accurate viewpoint possible. Armed with these tools, I then painted the artwork which would later be used in Jazz Day. It is a wonderful validation receive this award from those who know New York and books best. This confirms that this level of research is worthwhile, and I will continue to push myself to create the most authentic imagery I can. Truly, thank you very much.
Extraordinary book because it's an extraordinary story of life. It starts off in a relatively bucolic sense of a small part of New York in St. Albans and a family that is united by its family, its church, its community, and its relatives. And then what happens in a very short period of time is that the supports of this entire thing degenerate as the tenuous nature of the economic life of the family deteriorates, the neighborhood changes, people come in, and of course the terrible plights of the crack epidemic and the crime that is associated with it. And here's a young man who, living through this, and wants to preserve most of his family life, and at an early point becomes involved with the sale of drugs. And this goes on, and there's a progression of this period of time. And then there's an extraordinary scene in the book. In many ways, I think the most critical scene where, as a result of a conflict between the author and another person involved in the drug trade, he decides that he has to kill the person who has been threatening him, because the threat to him was to be killed himself. And he gets a gun, he takes this gun and marches up to the person and pulls the trigger. And what happens is that instead of a bullet coming out, there's a click. Because this was not a revolver, it was a gun with a clip, and it wasn't loaded properly, and it just clicked. But the more important click in the book at this point was not the click in the gun, but the click in the head of the author. But this told him he now had to do something else with his life. And here's a man who now decides to do a number of things. The first thing he needs to do is he realizes he has to get away from his neighborhood and to find a discipline that pleases him to do this. He goes into the army for a variety of reasons. He's in the army for 3 years, sent to the Middle East at one point, comes back, and what he wants to do is to become policeman, and wants in part to bring a sense of order, not only to his life, but in order to the communities that he looked at. A very intelligent and driven person progresses through the police department, notably rapidly, but yet at the same time is acutely aware of many of the problems, the conflicts of being a policeman in a city where the police department is permeated with a degree of racism and a degree of contempt for the people they're supposed to help. And yet at the same time, clear understanding that we need to have a police department to protect the weak from other people who seek to prey on them. And in the storybook, which goes on through basically 20 years of this, is a story of, I think, a man who buttressed by those initial supports of his life, family, faith, community, achieves a great deal, and at the end of the book, finds that he's been able to accomplish many things, but that some things were not able to be accomplished because of the institutional nature of the organization that he worked for, and yet has a very strong program for how things should be changed. And it's inspirational. It's a really wonderful book that I can recommend to everybody. Mr. James would come up and I'd like to give him the award of the society.
It's not a life that I'm very proud of, but there's some people in here Ed Woods, please stand up. This is my entertainment attorney. He's responsible for me getting the book deal. He represented some of the biggest artists at Charlotte Alamo. He's just done deals with Puff Daddy, Jay-Z. He's a reality star, actually. He has a reality show on the WE channel. He's kind of a big deal. He don't like people to say about that. Todd Hunter, my editor, who believed in me. Books, and he believed in me. So I went and told my story. I did a podcast and told, I did 21 years. I retired. I mean, Ray Kelly, I remember his secretary calling me one day and saying, hey, you got 45 minutes to get to the Marriott Hotel. Ray Kelly wants you to meet President Obama. He just won. He's the first black president. No. I'm like, Jeanette, stop playing with me. You crazy. She's like, Inspector, you got 45 minutes to go meet the president. I said, okay, I got my drive. I said, come on, let's go. We ran every red light. Let me take a picture. And, you know, I had a great career. I had rose to the top of the police department fairly quickly. And when I retired, I told my story of being a young kid. You know, my book is written in three parts. It's actually three books in one. Hustler, when I was in the street selling drugs and doing crazy stuff, growing up on welfare, all that crazy stuff. A cop and an executive. But the themes of the book are what's most important to self-awareness, self-actualization, transformation. I talk about police policies and procedures, but overall, what I want people to get out of the book is don't let your past identify or define your future. Because the kid on the back of that book, you would have never known that he would be this guy in the front of the book. You would have never known that he would be that. So it's very important. Damien in June, can you stand up? So these are two friends of mine. I made it my business because New York Society, Library Society, told me I could bring three people. I was like, well, I got about five people. I got to bring these people because characters in the book, characters that I grew up with, characters that I did crime with, that I sold drugs with, but we've changed our lives, you know. I'm the young black kid that everybody right now, the young kid that's in the street, he's selling drugs, and they just giving up on him, just boxing him in. You know, I ended up on the front page of the New York Post in 2013 after I told my story on this podcast, and it was this big picture with me and Derek Jeter. Oh, they know how to sell the newspapers. They put Derek Jeter, because they didn't think I was going to sell a paper. They put this big picture of me, and they put Thug Cop on the top of it, as if like I was flaking people, like I was robbing people, but I never committed a crime as a cop. Like they talk about Trump, they wait for Trump to do the pivot. I did the pivot. Once I left the streets, I swear to you, once I left the streets doing crimes, and I didn't kill anybody, so let's just be very clear on that. I have no bodies in the streets, but I did some crazy stuff that I'm not proud of. But once I made the pivot, I made the pivot. But they tried. When you pick up a newspaper, you see a picture of somebody, and it's an official picture, that picture, and it says, a cop. You think that, what is this guy doing? Is he setting people up? Is he robbing people? Is he, I didn't commit a crime. There's a story in the book where I stopped somebody with $25,000, and I could have took the money, and me and my partner wanted to take the money. He looked over the car at me and said, yo, let's go. I did the math really quick. I wasn't a mathematician, but I said, I'm going to make about $1.5 million for 20 years. This is $25,000. We're going to bust this down, $12,500. And it might be a setup. It's not worth it. So I knew I made the pivot. I want to just thank the New York Library Society for selecting me. Is my book agent in here, Peter McGuinn? I have to thank Peter McGuinn, Foundry, one of the top boutique agencies in New York and LA, for taking the chance with me, because I was trying to get a book deal for a couple of years, but when I hit the front page of that newspaper, Simon & Schuster, Random House, Double A, everybody was bidding on my story, and Todd Hunter and Atria Books, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster, they took a chance with me. I'm just humbly thankful for this opportunity. This is the second award, actually, for book, and we're just very proud of this book, and I appreciate you all for just giving me this opportunity. I'm just a young kid that grew up in Queens, made some bad choices and decisions, but actually changed my life. And you can't wipe away 27 years of my life that I was, you know, 18, from 13 to 18, I made bad decisions. I'm almost 50 years old. I'm a good guy now, I promise you. Thank you all.
Food and wine, and enjoy yourselves. Thank you for coming.